The children sat, legs crossed, watching the man pump his bellows, making the flames leap from their clay brazier ever larger, brighter and hotter. They hissed with their heat. Behind the children stood their parents, arms crossed, doubtfully waiting to be impressed. The man rocked left to right, leaning on leather bags either side of him, each push huffing air into the flames. The man paused, wiped the sweat from his dark forehead, and then ran his hand through his thick beard. Shaking out his hands, he returned to the rocking. The flames were beginning to roar. The air was filled with the chalky aroma of burning, and beneath it was the stink of the man's sweat. When the fire was almost too bright to look at, the man stopped. He stood up and ran his hand through his beard again. He picked up a short staff, one end charred black. Carefully, he eased the clay brazier over towards a hole in the earth. It rocked once, twice, and then tumbled, the flames bursting into clouds of spark as the charcoal shattered on the side of the hole. The man leaned over the hole. He reached in with one of his sticks and moved aside ashes, charcoal, and clay. He nodded his head slightly and reached for a second stick. From the black mess, he pulled out a raggedy lump of something. It was covered in holes and was as dark as the charcoal. The man placed it carefully into a pot and lifted that pot into a second fire. The process began again, pumping the bellows until the fire roared and sweat beaded on the man's forehead. Things were quicker this time. He worked more vigorously, pushing the bellows hard, forcing the flames to leap out bright and half translucent with heat. Keeping the bellows going with one hand, he reached behind himself for a flat rock with a shape carved into its face. The man leaps up, grabs the pot from the fire with his sticks, and then tips it above the flat rock with its carved shape. The children gasp as bright gold liquid pours from the pot and into the shape. It hisses and steams, and the man waits. The children return to their silence. They can't believe there's more. The man waits a little longer. The smoke and steam stops. He prods the object with a stick. Satisfied, he picks up a flint and eases out the liquid, now solid, that had filled the rock. The kids were craning their necks, trying to see what he was doing as he leaned over and began tapping at something. Beneath his long dark hair, he had the piece resting on a stone and was hitting it hard with another rock. The soot that had covered the object was flying off and flashes of gold could be seen. He then took handfuls of sand and rubbed them over the object with a woolen cloth. He then took that same cloth, dipped it in a wooden bucket of water, and rubbed the object over and over again. The man turns his back, hides what he is doing from view. There's a tug here, a grunt there, then he returns to face the crowd. His face is blackened with smoke, his hair matted with sweat. His eyes are glinting with pride. He lifts his hand, and in it is an axe. Its head isn't a black flint, though, but bright, shining gold. The children gasp and cheer. The grown-ups grunt unwilling approval. The man hands the axe to one of the adults, and they inspect it. The axe feels more balanced, more nimble in their hands. It's definitely lighter. They ask if it will break, and the man shakes his head. They ask if it will go dull, and he says yes, but it can be resharpened. He takes it back and runs the edge along a stone he splashes with water and sand. The sound is bright, sharp, and clear. A few strokes and the edge wants to cut flesh. The approval from the adults becomes a little more enthusiastic. One of them takes the axe and walks to a pile of logs. She swings the axe down and it bites deeply into the wood. She pulls it out, swings down hard, and the log cleaves in two. Nodding, impressed, she returns the axe to the man and asks him how they can get more. He asks for food, shelter, space, and materials, plus a sample of whatever it is they pride themselves on the most. They give him his own roundhouse, cattle, pigs, charcoal, fine, soft cloth from their long-haired sheep, and weaponry. Beautiful bows, supple and shining, delicate arrowheads, and braces of lustrous black shale. safe, warm, and comfortable. The man sets to work. Welcome back to the Bronze Age. Today we're following on directly from the Stonehenge episode, so you might want to give that a listen to if you've not done so yet. In this episode, we're going to cast our net wider to understand not just the society of Bronze Age Britain, but also how a scrap of land in Wiltshire, southwest England, fitted into a wider European civilization. This is the first time we have obvious inescapable civilizations, and they're not just in Western Europe. In Greece, we have the Mycenaeans, a people so glorious their exploits have entered into myth, giving us people like Odysseus, Agamemnon, and Achilles. On Crete, we have the Minoans, a civilization named after King Minos, the man who owned the Minotaur. Theirs is a rich, mercantile kingdom, with regular, vast feasts where young, lithe, and beautiful men and women leap over bulls and dance with each other in a heady, sensual ceremony. These two civilizations will lay the foundations for the classical Greek civilization, the father of modern Western society. In Turkey, the Hittites are creating a unique empire of mountaintop cities protected by vast armies, utilizing the nuclear weapons of their day, the war chariot. Further south, in Syria, there are kingdoms with names straight from the Bible. Wise Babylonians creating hanging gardens, inventing mathematics, and founding Babylon, the greatest city of the Bronze Age world. There are also the old Assyrians, violent men who created one of the first true empires. And then there is the queen of the Bronze Age civilizations, Egypt. During the time of our story, Egypt will be reaching the end of its old kingdom when the first pyramids were raised. Over the next two episodes, Egypt will descend into chaos, but out of that chaos will arise the Middle Kingdom, ancient Egypt's second golden age, when Osiris and Isis became important gods. The Bronze Age in Europe is a time when metal tools and weapons became widespread, when domestic horses first arrive in Europe, as do the first wheels. It is a time defined by a patchwork quilt of different civilizations, all interconnected but to massively varying degrees. Some of these kingdoms, like Egypt, become complex bureaucratic states, areas that will set precedents for the political rule we still follow today. Other, less complex societies, like those on the Atlantic coast of Europe, will be notable by their flexibility, their adaptability. Their willingness to engage and adapt will give birth to a whole world of weird traditions. The Bronze Age is a violent time, an adventurous time, and a time still wreathed in many mysteries. Today, we'll discuss the King of Stonehenge, the Amesbury Archer, and use him to explore the role Britain played in this complex patchwork of societies. I'm Andy Earnshaw, and welcome to Old Bones. Start the episode today with a man making metal. To create the story, I drew on experimental archaeology. It's a best guess approach to recreating the past. The man making the metal, though, he's not a best guess. He's real. He existed, and we call him the Amesbury Archer. The Amesbury Archer was discovered in 2002 in the village of Amesbury. That is the village which lies across the River Avon from Stonehenge. This burial is one of the richest burials in Britain ever, never mind just the Bronze Age. Strip away the houses that now cover the discovery site, though, and things become more interesting. Whilst he was buried on the opposite side of the river from Stonehenge, his burial is at the top of the valley, the peak of the hill, directly gazing across the valley towards Stonehenge. Whilst the Amesbury Archer was buried alone on a higher ridge, behind the Amesbury Archer lies Boscombe Down. In 2003, during digging work for a new water pipe, Wessex archaeology discovered seven burials dating from around the same time as the Amesbury Archer. He's not a one-off. In fact, surrounding Stonehenge are multiple set of burials, Kingborough Ridge Cemetery, Normanton Down Cemetery, Winterbourne Stoke Down, Durrington Furze, the Cursus Barrows, Lake Barrows and Lake Hill Barrows, to name a few. These burials date from the Bronze Age, with the Amesbury Archer being amongst the earliest to be buried in one of these cemeteries. He's the start of a tradition in the Bronze Age of burying men and women in close association with a monument that was at its peak of influence. As you might have guessed by the name of some of the cemeteries, they're usually buried beneath round barrows. A round barrow is an earthwork. In maps of Britain, they are often labelled as tumulus, which is deliciously Tolkien-esque. They begin with a burial, either a full body or the cremated remains of someone. The general rule is that men are more likely to be buried, whilst women are more likely to be cremated, but that's not fixed. Fixed ways of doing things aren't really what the Bronze Age goes in for. That burial, whether it's an interment or a cremation, then has a trench built around it. Archaeologists describe these ditches as curvilinear, which in normal speak is pretty circular. The earth from these ditches is then piled up in the middle. Sometimes that was lots of earth, creating bell barrows, which looked like someone dropped a cathedral bell of earth onto the ground. Other times it was just a little bit of soil, creating a disc barrow. In between those two extremes, there are other equally enjoyable names like bowl barrows, saucer barrows, or my favourite, pond barrows. I never managed to find any confident evidence or any rhyme or reason behind the choices of different mound styles. But the important thing is that these mounds cover a single burial. Later on, though, it's very common for other people to be buried in the mound itself, again, either as a full skeleton or a cremation. These so-called secondary burials are usually pretty plain. That doesn't hold true for the burial at the centre of the barrow. We don't know what type of barrow the Amesbury Archer had over his head. It's been ploughed away. When it comes to his grave goods, though, that's a very different story. You might want to follow on Instagram for the next bit. There's a lot of stuff to describe. The Amesbury Archer has been called a British Tutankhamun. His burial is that rich. In fact, it's a burial with 10 times the number of finds you'd expect to find in your average Bronze Age burial. The skeleton of the Amesbury Archer is a complete articulated skeleton, laying on its left side and crouched up into the fetal position. Now it comes to it, I think he's the first complete skeleton we've had in this series since Cheddar Man 5,000 years before him. Above his body were three small knives made of copper. Where his hair would have been, there were golden bands that would have held his long hair together in tresses or plaits. Behind his head was a small cushion stone, which showed evidence of being used as a small anvil for doing the delicate work of hammering copper and gold into its final, detailed form. Near his wrists were two black polished sandstone wrist guards. They had holes at either end for a string. These have been interpreted as braces, a piece of stone, metal or leather which protects the inside of the wrist from the whip snap of a bowstring. It's an interpretation supported by 16 finely made flint arrowheads dotted around his body. Four boar tusks that were also in his burial may have been tokens of his prowess as a hunter with the bow and arrow. By his neck, there was a bone pin, probably for holding a woolen cloak together. Not only did he have archery and metalworking equipment, he also had a spatula of red deer bone, good for removing the tiny flakes needed to create arrowheads like the ones in his grave. And there are many other flint tools, awls, knives, and scrapers. Finally, of course, he has five pots. Not just any pots, mind, but beaker pots. The Amesbury Archer is a beaker burial, a type of material culture that spread all across Europe in the early Bronze Age. But we'll come back to those people in a minute or two. It isn't just the Amesbury Archer's grave goods which we've learnt a lot from. We know that the Amesbury Archer was between 35 and 45 when he died, with a strong, heavy build. He had an abscess in his jaw which would have caused terrible, near constant toothache. But that wasn't the worst of his health issues. At least a year before he died, his left kneecap had somehow been ripped off. Although it healed, he wouldn't have been able to bend his left knee and would have walked with a swinging gait, which would have been exhausting. The things upon which every archaeologist can agree on is that when he died, he was very sick and quite old for an early agricultural community. He must have also been either greatly loved or highly respected. You see, burials are not the actions of the dead, the actions of the living in response to the relationship they had with the deceased. I think everyone is convinced that he's also an immigrant. When you are young and developing, your body draws minerals from the environment and uses them to create your body, for example, your teeth. As we discussed, elements like carbon, or in this case strontium, a close relation of calcium, have different isotopes, different formations of the element. The particular ratios of strontium isotopes are different in different regions of the world. You can take samples from the teeth of someone like the Amesbury Archer and analyse the strontium ratios he has. The results can point you to the region where the owner of the teeth grew up. The Amesbury Archer was an isotopic alien to southwest England. He grew up in Switzerland, 600 miles from Stonehenge, 30 miles of which are the stormy, vicious waters of the English Channel. By this period, Doggerland was a submerged and forgotten thing. He wasn't a lone wanderer, though. As we've said before, he wasn't a one-off. No, the Amesbury Archer was an early member of a famous group that stretched from Ireland to the River Danube, the Beaker people. Back in the early 20th century, archaeology wasn't the subject that it is today. Its focus was on defining history as a series of cultures which replaced each other. This archaeological approach purported to be able to create entire civilizations from just a few potsherds. Instead of talking about the Neolithic, Bronze Age, and Iron Age, a European archaeologist in the 1950s would talk about the Lindaband ceramic people being replaced by the Belbeke folk, who were in turn replaced by the Latin culture. There's a massive problem with understanding history this way. First of all, it's plain wrong. With the advent of radiocarbon dating, we have discovered that there was often a lot of crossover between these cultures, which undermines the theoretical foundations of this approach to history. Secondly, it creates a world where more advanced cultures eventually replace their weaker neighbours. The Nazis, Italian fascists, and Soviets all use this archaeological approach to justify a whole heap of evil. The past isn't a rotating door of cultures. People aren't replaced. Instead, they adapt, evolve, improve, or sometimes just plain change for the joy of it. Yes, sometimes those evolutions or adaptations are in response to a violent upheaval. But just as often, it is due to new discoveries, changes in taste, or simply curiosity. All that said, these material culturalists, as they're often called, did have a knack for coming up with evocative names. The history they imagine is simple and easy to understand. Reality lacks the definition of their story. So now, in the 21st century, nearly 60 years since we stopped thinking along those lines, we're still stuck with many of the names those archaeologists invented. One of those names was the Belbeke culture. This has been used to describe the rapid appearance of a specific type of pot. These pots are elegant things, curving in towards their middle and heavily decorated, every inch of them. These are the eponymous Belbekers, and they're the most distinctive part of the early European Bronze Age civilization, which is a much bigger mouthful than Belbeke culture. It wasn't just pottery. It's during this period that metalworking exploded across the continent. With it came other phenomena. There was much more travel using rivers and oceans. It was probably during this time the domesticated horse was first introduced to Europe, and as we all know from last episode, megalithic monumentality reached new heights. There were other innovations, for example, the individual round barrows that people like Amesbury Archer were buried beneath. There also seems to be a new focus on archery, not just in the Amesbury Archer's burial, but across the continent. In the Neolithic, arrowheads, which had been de rigueur in the Mesolithic, became far less common. In the Bronze Age, they returned to their previous popularity. The funny thing is that the Bronze Age sees a continued growth of agriculture and animal husbandry, which suggests that hunting continued to become less and less vital as a source of food. Red deer were still hunted, but the main sources of meat in the Bronze Age are very much cows and pigs. This suggests that either hunting became an important cultural activity in the same way it was amongst the aristocracy in Victorian Britain, but on the other hand, it could also suggest an increase in warfare. But we're getting ahead of ourselves. We're not finished with the Amesbury Archer yet. The Amesbury Archer was part of a wider cultural movement, yes, but it was also a pioneer. His burial is among the earliest Belbeke burials in Britain. It is by far and away the richest Bronze Age burial on these islands, and it's the first one ever to include metalworking. In fact, the metalworking tools in his burial are the earliest evidence we have to suggest people were creating metal in Britain 4,300 years ago. All of which prompts a lot of questions. Why was he in Britain? What role did he play within society? Why was he buried with such magnificence? And what was the connection between him and Stonehenge? To answer that question properly, we need to contextualise his burial. We need to step away from the bones and better understand the world the Amesbury Archer lived in. Stick around. We're talking civilization next. I've called the Amesbury Archer a representative of a Bronze Age civilization, not Bronze Age society or culture. Civilization. That's a big word, civilization. It's easy to call what's happening in Egypt a civilization. They've got kings, slaves, writing systems, and a civil service. The good, the bad, and the ugly, civilizationally speaking, ancient Egypt's got it all. Things aren't as clear in Britain. Stonehenge is as impressive as anything anywhere, suggesting organization at a civilization level. The Amesbury Archer is a rich burial. Again, as rich as anything that is taking place in Egypt at the time. There's hints of something complex, but none of the details we have in Egypt. Instead, to try and understand what this civilization was like, we have to be clever. Every piece of evidence needs to be treated as a precious, priceless artifact, a piece of an atomized jigsaw. We don't have many of these jigsaw pieces, but I think we've got enough to get a fragmentary image of what is happening. The image that is emerging, fractal and fractured as it is, suggests a world defined by relationships. This is an idea we explored last episode, and it makes sense to briefly recap how this relational worldview was represented in the religion of Bronze Age Europe. As you should remember, we argued that the definitive ritual was a journey that mirrored that of the ancestors. People would feast, enjoy what life had to offer in the bright light of day, before travelling down a river to Stonehenge and conducting sombre rituals in the dark, before the sun arose, bringing back light and life. On this journey, there were many relationships, the interplay of the world and the cosmos, the river and the dry land, stone and wood, day and night, feast and famine, locations and journeys. Monuments highlighted these dichotomies. All of this was the pinnacle, the encapsulating moment of a religion based on connecting the natural world of rivers and forests, the ancestral world of stone of darkness, and the universal world of the sun and stars. Journeys played a big role, as did place, and all of the monuments built to celebrate this required vast, cohesive efforts to create. For millennia, places like Stonehenge acted as cathedrals, places which people visited over and over again and deliberately chose to be associated with. This suggests that the meaning of Stonehenge, what it was set up to celebrate, remained important. Since religion is a mirror of society, this dichotomous relational worldview suggested by monuments like Stonehenge suggests that the whole of Bronze Age society was relational. We're going to talk about how relationships with people and ideas define Bronze Age economics and politics. There's a reason there hasn't been anything as uniquely impressive as Stonehenge before in this podcast. There's a reason the Amesbury Archer is the richest burial so far. It's only now that we start to get proper economies. Yes, we've had long-distance trade, jet beads moving from Yorkshire to Orkney, for example. However, that's been a unique thing, community to community, not a non-stop, large-scale continental phenomena. That's changing now. The Amesbury Archer, born in Switzerland, buried in Wiltshire, is just one of many beaker burials who are buried hundreds of miles from their homes. But why did trade and immigration kick off in such a big way? The first thing to mention is that the climate improved during the early Bronze Age. Climatically, we're in a period called the Mount Pleasant Phase. During this time, the climate became, well, pleasant. It became warmer, wetter, and better for growing crops. There is a suggestion in some of the archaeological records that this improvement in climate was matched by an improvement in agricultural techniques, for example, using domesticated horses to pull ploughs more quickly. Richer, better farmed land led to more food, creating a larger and more affluent society. As we discussed when we were in Orkney, this allowed for a more complex society with people focusing on specific activities. Some of these people invested in improving on the technologies of the late Neolithic period. A few hundred years after the Amesbury Archer died, we have the first evidence of boats. Proper boats, not canoes or rafts. They're called stone plank boats, a marvellously prosaic name. What the Bronze Age people did, you see, was to take planks of wood, right? Drill holes in the wood and overlap the planks so the holes match up. They then took a piece of rope and sewed the planks together, giving us a sewn plank boat. This approach has many advantages. First of all, you can make the boats into whatever shape you like. This allows you to make larger boats capable of holding more cargo and more people. Those extra people might help you row the boat. You might even decide to create a boat which is more streamlined. Larger, faster and more powerful boats make ocean travel safer and make regular trips across tempestuous seas like the English Channel more feasible. This is compounded by the build of the boats. Because the planks are sewn together, they're flexible. When a heavy wave hits the side of a sewn plank boat, it doesn't roll like a canoe made of a single log. Instead, the planks flex, absorbing the impact and reducing the chance of capsizing. Finally, if your boat breaks, it's a matter of replacing a few planks. That makes it cheaper to own and maintain a boat. These bigger, faster and, well, better boats had major impacts on the amount of continental trade in the Bronze Age. Europe is a riverine continent. Rivers like the Seine, Rhine, Loire, Thames, Danube and Po are major trade routes today. 4,300 years ago, they were the superhighways, supported by a web of other rivers like the River Avon that drifts past Stonehenge. These gave people access to new people, new products and, of course, new relationships. In these boats were many goods. Of course, above all, these boats were filled with bell beakers. The fact the entire civilization is named after them speaks to just how far they spread. What's really exciting, though, is that in the holds of these ships, hidden by bell beakers, bales of wool and flint tools, were sparkling things. The first metal objects. There are five forms metal takes during this period. The first two are industrial forms. There's the rough ore and the more refined ingots. Both raw materials for producing more notable objects. They're important to mention, though. There are two shipwrecks, the Ulubaran shipwreck off the south coast of Turkey and the Salcombe shipwreck off the south coast of England. Both are much later than our current period, from a similar period to next episode. But both have very few finished metal objects in them. What they instead have are many, many copper and tin ingots, slabs of pure metal destined for future processing. Now, of course, they're later than the period we're talking about, but they suggest an economy that is becoming more integrated, with one area producing ore, another area for refining the metal, and a third final area crafting objects from the metal. However, it also shows us how metal was potentially moved around during Bronze Age Europe. Not as finished objects, but as hefty chunks of raw material destined to be shaped by local people in their own style. The other three forms are what those local people did with the metal. The easiest to understand is jewellery. Gold is available in the rivers of Wales as flecks and nuggets, as is tin in Cornwall. From a very, very early period, humans began to turn gold into jewellery. Even in civilizations that never really mastered metalworking like the medieval Incas, gold was used as jewellery. It has a very low melting point and is very malleable, easy to form into whatever shape you wish. The next thing to appear were tools. The flint hand axe is the most useful tool humans ever produced. For millions of years, it was a natural extension of most human hands. When it was discovered that copper could be smelted into shapes, and then when it was set, it was sharp, hard, and durable, humans started casting the copper and later bronze into hand axes, which they strapped to wood and used like the flint axes they loved. Before we get onto the third type, we best talk about bronze. We've flung the word around like nobody's business. However, I haven't really told you what bronze is yet. You see, creating bronze is a massive leap forward technologically from simply casting raw copper and hammering it into final shapes. As we've mentioned, gold is a non-reactive element. You can find it glinting in the mountains and streams. It's an obvious target for a Neolithic baleen. Tin also is pretty easy to find. Many are the Cornish folk who's made a bit of extra cash panning for tin in rivers and streams. Copper, too, turns rocks into bright green malachite. There's obvious signs of something special in amongst the silicon. Once you learn that heating up odd rocks gives you metal, it's not hard to understand the discovery of copper or tin. Bronze isn't an element, though. It doesn't occur naturally. Instead, you need to combine copper and tin. Not one for one either. No, you need about 10% of the mix to be tin to make a metal that has a rich golden sheen and is harder and more durable than either of its parent metals. This is bronze. Bronze is brilliant for tools, and soon people traded in their copper axe for ones of bronze. It's harder and more durable. It's not an uncommon thing to be chopping at a tree with your new bronze hand axe and wonder, if a tool is so good at removing forests, how good is it at removing human heads? The third type of tools we get in the Bronze Age are weapons. Axes, shields, spears, swords and daggers. In fact, the first swords in the archaeological record. Unfortunately, for the violent-minded of you, we won't be talking more about swords today. The Amesbury Archer dates from the early Bronze Age. The most complex weapon he had was a short copper dagger, at best a sidearm and more likely a tool. All of these metal objects became useful objects, yes, objects of status too, but also of personal identity. People weren't just acquiring metal to better chop up woodland, they were turning the fruits of their labour into beautiful jewellery that they wore themselves. Agriculture, metalworking and seafaring, these aren't just the basis of the Bronze Age economy, they sit at the heart of our modern world too. It's during the Bronze Age that we see the real split with our hunter-gatherer past. It's the start of our modern world, the foundational time for everything we have today. This improved farming, greater interconnectivity, and technological advances come from somewhere. That somewhere is the special place between two people's minds. The truth is, every major advance in human history isn't the result of one independent genius blessed by a flash of inspiration. Instead, innovation is the product of humans interacting with each other. Someone wonders something out loud, another person thinks it's a good idea, and a third person sets to making it a reality. Improvements in boating technology and the spread of metalwork speak to the importance of relationships. People were working together to make their world a better place. And what did they do with the newfound creativity? They wanted to share it with the world. The Bronze Age economy becomes fundamentally about sharing ideas and sharing wealth. It becomes about combining earth and fire into metal and pottery, taking the products of the land and onto the waters. This greater wealth affected the politics of the Bronze Age too. Early archaeologists were convinced that during the Bronze Age we see the definite rise of kings. I think the unique wealth of Amesbury Archer's burial suggests a degree of political stratification. Some people definitely had more wealth and by inference more powers than others in their communities. But kings is a strong word. For now though, let's accept that there was stratification. What form did that social stratification take? Again, it's a question of what relationships existed. I think there are three basic ideas as to who the leaders of the Bell Beaker civilization were. There's the violent relationship, the warrior kings. The religious relationships, the priest kings, or the economic relationships, the trader kings. Now I know, I heavily insulted the term priest king a few episodes ago, but stick with me, I'm going to insult the whole idea soon. Let's start with the classic view, the warrior king, the idea that Bronze Age society was defined by violence. I guess you could just call this theory kings because, sort of by definition, kings tend towards violence, as do would-be kings. They believe, not always incorrectly, that by showing dominance over other people, they will secure their popularity. Uneasy rests the head that wears the crown, and killing other people for their goods helps that heavy head forget from time to time. The Amesbury Archer is often imagined as this warrior king. He's surrounded by the panoply of war, metal daggers and war bows. He has been seen as a brave warrior from a distant land who has taken over the rich lands of Stonehenge. Indeed, he's evidence for an old view that the spread of the Bell Beaker culture was a violent one led by brave warriors. Injuries like the total loss of the Amesbury Archer's kneecap are reminiscent of some pretty horrific war injuries. Unfortunately for this quite exciting theory, it appears the early Bronze Age was relatively peaceful. The kneecap injury could have been caused by much more than warfare. Bows and daggers might speak to a hunter. And in all honesty, there isn't much evidence for warfare at this early stage. That's not to say it didn't happen. But if the question is whether the relationship between the ruler and ruled is one of cowed fear of a violent man, we'd expect to see much more glorification of violence. Other later Bronze Age and Iron Age cultures would take a visceral delight in describing how they butchered their enemies. There's none of that here, in art or in monumentality. There's nothing. The early Bronze Age is a prosperous time, a time when wealth increased, as did populations, and as did interactions between distant communities. Of course, wealth, slaves, and exotic goods are all the results of warfare, but without other conclusive evidence, it's a bold claim to suggest that an entire culture's relationship with other people was based on brutality. For my money, there were violent relationships in the Bronze Age. The trade we'll discuss in a moment sometimes descended into brutality as deals went awry or the poorer people chose to use violence to balance the scales a little bit. The warfare was primarily bow-based warfare and featured small bands of psychopathically heroic individuals, rather than the large-scale state-sponsored invasions we see in the later Bronze Age in the Eastern Mediterranean. But fundamentally, war was not seen as life's purpose. Sites like Stonehenge suggest that the people of the Bronze Age were more complicated, nuanced, and philosophical than that. Furthermore, the Ainsbury archer wasn't buried just as a warrior. Instead, he was surrounded by jewellery, metalworking equipment, and pottery. These might not be the spoils of war, but the rewards of entrepreneurship. A more modern theory is that status was earned in the Bronze Age, not by prowess on the battlefield, but by the wealth he brought to the community. You might be well respected if you were a particularly gifted farmer or potter, which brought the community greater wealth and comfort. Indeed, the Boscombe Bowmen buried beneath the Ainsbury Archer were local people with rich burials. This is similar to the ideas we explored when discussing society in late Neolithic Orkney. In the Bronze Age, though, the people who brought the most wealth, who gained the most status, were the traders. These people amassed great wealth, giving their communities prestige, bankrolling vast monuments, and attracting lots of power to themselves. They became trader kings. Before we go any further, I need to draw attention to bias. This idea that I'm about to explore is one I find particularly attractive. I think it's well supported by the evidence and suggests a society moving gradually away from egalitarianism to hierarchy. However, I'm a liberal capitalist, someone who believes in building a world of equal opportunity and competition. Of course, it makes sense to me that a society that was at its core egalitarian would honour the people who made their lives better, both material and, as we'll see later, spiritually. It speaks to some of the fundamental beliefs I have about the world. In that way, I'm no better than those early archaeologists who saw the world engendered violent black and white. However, that's the nature of the past. It's not a well of truth, but a mirror for our times. We hope that by peering into the mirror of history, we see the reality of human society, but very often our own faces get in the way. So then, with that bias in mind, what is the evidence that the Bronze Age might have featured trader kings holding fabulous wealth? Well, much of what we find in the Ainsbury Archer's burial for one, but also in the rise of metalworking, seafaring, and cultural cohesion in general. Let's begin with the evidence of the Ainsbury Archer as a trader. Essentially, I see his burial as that of a rich foreigner. Switzerland might not be far away from Essex now. Indeed, plenty of people from modern-day Wiltshire are having some extremely expensive holidays in the Swiss Alps as we speak. 4,300 years ago, it was another world. Mountainous instead of gently hilly, a continental climate instead of the year-round mild sogginess of Western Britain, and much, much closer than Britain to the exciting things happening in the Eastern Mediterranean. The Ainsbury Archer must have been an enterprising man to have travelled so far. He's quite old, probably approaching 40, and his bones speak to a hard life. His skeleton is far more battered than many of its contemporaries, his teeth were riddled with disease, and as I've said, his entire kneecap was missing. The Ainsbury Archer was a man from over the seas, with a body racked by the turmoil of a life on the road. The wealth of his tomb also suggests that his injuries speak to his way of life rather than the scars of poverty. As we've said, this is the richest tomb from this period in Britain by a long, long way. many of the grave goods suggest a man who travelled a lot. As we've spoken about, during the Bronze Age, agriculture became more important and hunting less so. It is strange then to see the Amesbury archers surrounded by high-quality hunting equipment and hunting trophies. Bows, arrows, archery equipment, pins for his thick cloaks, 4 boar tusks, and all the equipment he needed to keep his bow and arrow in good repair, even when he was far away from a settlement. It might be that, as a kingly figure, he enjoyed hunting like so many kings have done. However, it might be also that he was someone who was famously self-reliant, comfortable to travel on his own for long periods, surviving off the land. It's an interesting point that somebody else who was found in the Alps, Otzi the Iceman, had similar equipment on his body and was probably killed whilst travelling through those Alps. The Amesbury Archer, then, isn't just a lone traveller, but he's part of this trend that we've already discussed. The answer to why the Amesbury Archer in particular was travelling around Europe at this time is in the metal goods he has with him. The press breathlessly reported that the Amesbury Archer was the man who brought metal to Britain. No, I don't know about that. But if he wasn't the first, he definitely was an early pioneer. Someone who had spotted a gap in a market, worked hard to fill those gaps, and paid the price in an isolated life filled with physical injuries, but with fabulous wealth. He died with his long hair held together with fine gold tresses. By his side, he had knives of copper, and with him, he had the tools for crafting gold. We've already explored how metal was traded, not in finished objects, but in ingots of processed metal. It might be that the Amesbury Archer came to Britain, a country full of copper, tin and gold, not to sell finished goods, but to trade knowledge for access and status. He came to the island, knowing how to work goods and knowing of sources of metal on the island. He would visit communities, working a territory, showing them how to work the shiny metal, which he then provided to them for food, board and other goods like cloth, flint, bone, pot, and eventually the metal goods they learned to make. He wouldn't have been buying and selling in the same way we think of it. Coins are a long way off still. But there's more than one way to build an economy, and this reciprocal trade could have made a man very rich and very respected as a giver of the most unique gifts of all. Metal. It's also not surprising that an early metal trader was buried at Stonehenge. Britain's gold comes mostly from the Welsh mountains, and one principal source of British gold is in Carmarthenshire, a region that neighbours Pembrokeshire. And that region is famous for the Preseli Hills, the source of Stonehenge's bluestones. Incidentally, those bluestones had only just been raised when the Amesbury Archer died. Stonehenge's connection with Wales was fresh in the minds of people. It was still active. Nor is the Amesbury Archer the only burial in Britain to be associated with trade. In East Yorkshire, there is a burial called the Gristhorpe Man. He's buried near the seaside resorts of Scarborough and Filey. His barrow is the central one of 3, and his is another very special burial. His middle barrow is larger than the other 2, and also contains flint tools, animal goods, and bronze daggers, the ore from which came from Ireland, another land that was distant and foreign 4,300 years ago. A rich man who died old from natural causes. Sounds like plenty of businessmen I know of. What's especially interesting about Gristhorpe Man is that he was buried in a log coffin, which survived because the ground in that part of the world is perennially sopping wet. This log coffin is reminiscent of the log canoes that would soon be replaced, but had made settlement in Orkney and Ireland possible during the Neolithic. The coffin also makes the alignment of the burial incontrovertible. The barrow is on the cliff, and the man is looking out across the North Sea to Europe, a place forever connected to the Yorkshire coast by the long shorelines of Northwest Europe, Scandinavia and the British Isles. He is another man linked by the oceans to a wider world, buried in a way that suggests he grew rich and popular in peaceable activities, not violent battle. Brave warriors have very low life expectancies. And these traders, both associated with the oceans and with metalworking, were part of a wider cultural movement. The Belbeca culture covered all of Europe and shows many of the same features again and again. This is a time where there's much greater connectivity between people than previously. We see a lot of genetic shifts in the population during this period, and we have many people, like the Amesbury Archer, dying far from where they grew up. It's a world where migration was commonplace, and places like Stonehenge brought all sorts of folk to a single special place. This was also a time when agricultural communities had their own rich people. Many very rich beaker burials are of people who are extremely local. These communities, though, were tied together by oceans and rivers, sailed by traders bringing fine pots, food, and well-made goods. These travellers were how these communities connected to the wider world, bringing wealth and news with them. In return, they were given respect, hospitality, and prestige. So they're not necessarily kings, but I find this image of the role played by the Ainsbury Archer a compellingly different way of thinking about the past. But as great as the burial is, to focus on the grave itself is to ignore a vital part of this burial. Its location. Stonehenge, as always, looms large, distorting interpretations. You see, rich the Ainsbury Archer may have been, but he was old and sick. It might have been that he was no king, no rich trader, but a pilgrim, looking to use his wealth to bring him close to the greatest religious site in Europe. When the ancestors did not heal him, he may have decided that the next best thing would be to join them and live out eternity in the most special place of all. That doesn't prevent us from interpreting him as a traitor. But his wealth might not have been translated into direct political power. He might also have been a priest king. Stonehenge clearly had international significance, reaching as far west as the Irish Sea and as far south and east as Switzerland. It may be that people flocked to Stonehenge, some as pilgrims, but others as those seeking enlightenment. It might be that the Ainsbury Archer came early in his life, a special child, and became such a powerful religious figure that upon his death, he had amassed wealth and respect, and so his burial reflected that. In the bows and arrows he's buried with, we don't see evidence of warfare or a life spent hunting, but of a remembered past, one where hunting was the way of life. When you went to join the ancestors, you were given a bow, arrows and knives, so you could join them in the eternal hunt. It could also be that metalworking was such a marvellous magical process that it was only done by priests. That's not as odd as it sounds. For example, we've already seen later communities associating Neolithic longbarrows with gods who are blacksmiths. Wayland Smithy is named after the Anglo-Saxon god Wayland. It's said that if you leave your horse overnight with some gold, then Wayland will leave the longbarrow in which he resides and shoe your horse for you. I don't know anybody who's actually tried that. Metalworking, whether done by these beggar gods of the Anglo-Saxons or the volcanic Greco-Roman gods, has a magical element to it. You turn rock to liquid and then into beautiful objects. It's hard, loud, smoky and mysterious work. Metal could have started life as a religious material. Then again, since the first things to be made with copper and bronze were usually tools and weapons, I hope not. I'm not sure I can stomach warrior priest kings. It's a little too World of Warcraft. If all this is true, then that knee injury must have been a horrific accident. How does a priest lose a kneecap? And why were they drawn to Stonehenge when it's not the only religious place between Wessex and Switzerland? To be honest with you, like warrior king interpretations, I find priest king explanations a bit of a McDonald's theory. Superficially satisfying, but a bit lacking in substance when you bite into them. Then again, I'm not really convinced by any of the arguments I presented to you. I think the word king has its own problems. We've not got evidence of any people deciding policy or driving society forward like true autocrats. The way I think of the Ainsbury Archer is as an itinerant metalworker. Someone who traded his knowledge and skill for what counted for wealth in the Bronze Age. His bravery, travelling great distances, was highly respected, and his mystical connection to the new art of metalworking gave him worldly riches, social status, and a connection to mystical places, like Stonehenge. I'm sure that if he spent any time in any community, he would have had more influence than his neighbours. He would have known more about the world than many of the commoners, but he wouldn't have been the only person in those communities with wealth, power, and prestige. Instead, Bronze Age politics would have been all about relationships, who you knew, what you knew, and how you interacted with people. Society at this time was still quite egalitarian, and spoiler, it's going to remain quite egalitarian for the entire series. Even the Celts were egalitarian when compared with the Romans. So even if you were a magical man of metal, if you wanted to exercise power, you couldn't simply command. You had to negotiate and influence people. You had to be charming and sensible. You had to have a good track record. From certain angles, the Bronze Age seems to be a strikingly modern world. Don't be fooled. We don't know what charming was in Bronze Age Britain, nor do we know what a good track record looks like. However, we can be sure of one thing. Whatever the game of politics looked like 4,300 years ago, the Amesbury Archer was a master, and upon his death, he was given every honour the people could muster. Today, we've glanced through history's curtain and spotted the beginnings of hierarchy, the kernels of international trade, and the first proper European civilization, a culture with shared political institutions, economic models, and similar social beliefs and structures. It might not be well defined or obvious. It might not be a complex civilization, but it's definitely a civilization. In that sense, early Bronze Age Britain and Western Europe are going through the same process as places like ancient Egypt, Babylonia, Crete, and Anatolia. All of these places are forging unique civilizations, many of which will go on to change how we see the world today. Indeed, there are echoes of the Bell Beaker civilization in our society today, and that's because there are echoes of that Bronze Age society in the Celts, Vikings, and Anglo-Saxons, the peoples whose legacies have come to define modern Britain. In that sense, we can consider the Amesbury Archer a truly great Briton, a man who played a critical role at a pivotal time in our history. Between now and the end of this series, much of what we've laid down today will play out again and again. The struggle between increasing hierarchy and its continued reliance on support from both religious institutions and the common people is a big one, as is the importance of high-quality metalworking, brave individuals, and international trade. Before then, though, we've got to take a journey north, back up to Scotland. We're going to Cladhallan to talk about the weirdest religious practice we'll ever discuss. Centuries-old, Bronze Age British mummies. Prepare to be a little creeped out. I'm Andy Earnshaw, and this is Old Bones. See you soon.